Well, it is the 4th of July weekend, and it certainly is a time to enjoy family and friends and fattening food and fireworks. It's also become a particularly auspicious day for citizenship ceremonies. Now, like most immigrants, I remember this day very, very well, this day that I became a U.S. citizen. It was a blustery fall day in 1975 in downtown Toledo. Now, there was no public ceremony like this. I didn't get a little tiny flag. There was just one kind, unhurried federal worker in that building, clearly, at least on this day, enjoying his job. But it was no less momentous for me, and I still hold it up as one of the happiest days of my life. I'm wondering about the folks in this congregation who were born U.S. citizens. How many were born U.S. citizens? So do you remember the first time you realized what that meant? Do you remember thinking about that part of your identity? Was it your first civics class in elementary school? Was it the first time you voted? Was it the first time you heard the stories from Seneca Falls or Selma? Do you remember? So there are two aspects of citizenship, right? There is individual freedom, and then there is collective responsibility, autonomy and obligation. Parker Palmer has written his latest book, and it's entitled The Healing Heart of Democracy. He emphasizes that the communitarian aspect of citizenship is a way of being in the world, a way of being in the world rooted in the knowledge that I am a member of this vast community of humans and non-humans that I depend on for things that I could never provide for myself. Even as an 11-year-old, I understood that my new status as a U.S. citizen came with benefits, certainly, but also a duty to be a good citizen. Now, what does that mean? What does it mean to be a good citizen? You vote? What else? You pay taxes? You help other people? You participate? You participate. You protest. Now, the poet Auden, he described one type of good citizen, didn't he? Someone that was sensible, reasonable, quiet, didn't ruffle the feathers, didn't cause too many waves, definitely voted, paid taxes, law-abiding, sensible, responsible person. The good citizen does vote and reads the paper. The good citizen definitely, though, does not walk toward trouble. The good citizen is good. But good is not good enough in these times in which we live. As our nation enters its 239th year, we continue to see the persistent decline in civic participation. We see this not only at the voting booth, but also at the PTA, the League of Women Voters, fraternal organizations, and yes, in the churches. Dropping out of public spaces means that we are dropping out of the public dialogue. And this is not good. The threats to our democracy are not necessarily from terrorists, either foreign or domestic. The threats are right here. And when I say right here, I actually mean right here. Now, first, there is our hyper-individualism. I've talked about this before. We want what we want when we want it, right? And the marketplace keeps giving us exactly what we want when we want it. We overemphasize individual freedom and personal autonomy, while the values of interdependence and obligation to other and the collective responsibility are left to wither on the vine. And so now we have people who will insist on the right to take their guns into Target without considering their obligation not to scare the little kids who are shopping for Legos. And our ego attachment to our cars, which is so linked up with our personal identity, leads some people to drive even when they shouldn't be driving. The second threat to American democracy is the idolatry of the marketplace at the expense of compassion. Cornel West once said that one of the worst things that the older generation did for his was to tell them for 25 years over and over again, be successful, be successful, be successful. Nobody ever told them to be great, be great, be great. There is a qualitative difference, he continues. Success, he says, is very individualistic. It's privatistic, concerned only with one's upward mobility. But to be great, on the other hand, is to be willing to serve others. Working to be successful rather than great has left us with unbelievable levels of wealth inequality. It has created an atmosphere where our leaders apparently feel free to speak very cold-heartedly about the suffering of our most vulnerable citizens. Now, the third and perhaps the most devastating threat to American democracy is this growing sense of hopelessness. A mass resignation is how the historian Lawrence Goodwin describes this particular threat. A mass resignation. He says it's like believing in the dogma of democracy privately or at a superficial level, but not really believing it privately in the heart. Hope no longer seems to be the operative dynamic in America, and without hope, we lose the talent and the drive to cooperate in the shaping of our destiny. Now, I know for a fact, because I have talked to you about this, I know that many of you have lost hope. I know that some of you have seriously considered renouncing your U.S. citizenship. I know that you have lost hope. But you know what? It is precisely your brokenheartedness that is needed to save our democracy. We need people not only to believe in the idea of democracy, you know, as this vague principle, but to believe in the original sense of that word, beloved. We need people to love democracy, to hold it close to your hearts. So here's Dr. Cornel West again saying, America, America, this monument to the genius of ordinary men and women, ordinary men and women, this place where hope becomes capacity, this long, halting turn of no into yes, needs citizens who love it enough to reimagine and to remake it. So, do you love it enough? Do you believe enough? Do you believe it not as just a guiding principle, but do you beloved it? I don't know. I'm seeing a little hesitation out there. It is indeed a cynical time, isn't it? To be a good citizen in times such as ours, we need to do more than just vote in the next election, more than pick up litter on Ironbound Road, as great as that is. And Roger, it's looking really good out there. Thank you. We need to do more than just hit the like button on the Facebook page or sign online petitions. That's good. It's not good enough. As our president reminded us in his second inaugural speech, we have an obligation to shape the debate of our time, not only with the votes we cast, but with the voices we lift in defense of our most ancient and most enduring ideals. And so, to lift up your voice means more than just click, click, click. We must speak directly and loudly against those forces that break our hearts and oppress the humanity of our brothers and sisters. Those forces of racism, male supremacy, wealth inequality, homophobia. We need to speak loudly and directly, frankly and honestly. Now, right away, I have three ways that you can practice this, okay? First of all, you knew this was coming. Tomorrow, right, Mr. Whitley? Tomorrow, you can join the Moral Monday group out on Duke of Gloucester Street at noon. 11:45, okay, get there a little early, 11:45, in front of the Kimball Theater. And stand in solidarity with others to support Medicaid expansion. Second, all of you got one of these. This is not a poster, it's a postcard. And this postcard is something that you can use to write a note in longhand, okay? In longhand to your federal or state representative about something that breaks your heart. What breaks your heart? You need to tell them about that. And then third, keep an eye out on our monthly social justice newsletter, because there will be a public action at a date to be determined, led by Jessica O'Brien and her team, that will raise the awareness of the problem of mass incarceration, also known as the new Jim Crow. It is not enough to be just a good citizen these days. Maybe it was at the time that Auden wrote his poem. But today, what we need is Good Citizen 2.0. We need the next generation of good citizen. We need to learn how to listen to others, not only their words, because I tell you, if you just listen to their words, it will drive you crazy. Learn to listen to their hearts. Go past the words and the rhetoric. Learn to listen to their hearts with yours. We need to learn to listen, but we also need to learn how to speak. We need to learn how to speak to one another without denying the inherent worth and dignity of the other person. We need to learn how to disagree. We need to learn how to disagree well. We need to learn how to be comfortable with conflict as a source of great creative energy. Conflict is not a bad thing. Conflict allows us to grow and expand. And finally, Good Citizen 2.0 needs to have the capacity to be brokenhearted over the issues that affect our community. Now, you can't be brokenhearted unless you know what's going on. You can't be brokenhearted if the TV is off and you refuse to read the newspapers because it's too troubling. Now, I know that if you're struggling with something in your own personal life, taking on the additional burdens of the world, it's just going to be too much. And for those of you, I say, turn off the TV. Don't read the paper, okay? Take care of yourself. That's all right. But for the vast majority of you who are strong, you know, in will, and you feel pretty good, you got no excuse. Citizen 2.0 requires you to be willing to be brokenhearted. Are you willing to be brokenhearted? Now, these skills, being comfortable with conflict and listening really deeply to the heart of another, and speaking very directly to the inherent worth and dignity of another. These are skills that do not come naturally. You don't just pop out of the womb knowing how to do these things. So where do you learn? Where do you learn how to do this? If you were lucky, your family told you. Your family taught you. Maybe you had a great teacher. Maybe you had a great mentor. But you know what? This place is a great place to learn those skills. De Tocqueville once said that habits are more important than laws in creating and sustaining liberty. And so we need good habits of the heart. We need good habits of democratic process. And this is the best place I know of where to learn those things. Starting with our youngest Unitarian Universalists, our religious education program has never and will never be about indoctrinating youth into a set of religious creeds. It's about nurturing our youth to use their individual capacity to think and their freedom to think and their capacity to direct their own lives into a service of justice and compassion and love. Our religious community is grounded in 7 principles, as most of you know. At first glance, they don't seem particularly religious, especially that 5th principle. The 5th principle says that we covenant to affirm and promote the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and society at large. Now, it's a noble value, but I'm pretty sure that when you are on your deathbed, you are not going to be comforted by those particular words. And I promise I won't bring them to you unless you really want it. These principles are here to guide our everyday lives. Since the birth of our movement in North America, the value of religious freedom has shaped our ideas of democracy. In the 18th century, the Unitarians and the Universalists, in their opposition to Calvinist predestination, believed in the human capacity to shape our own destiny. Freedom, then, becomes a fundamental value for both streams of our faith. Free from creedal tests, free from a preordained fate, free from tyranny, and free to govern ourselves, democracy is one of our great core values. Because democracy for us is an expression of faith. It's an expression of the faith in the power of people to shape their own lives, and it is a call to use that power for the sake of the common good. Now, while it is possible for a democracy to flourish and function without religious sentiment, it does require a level of consciousness of other people and a care for others that I would have to call spiritual. Spirituality, as I have said here before, is the experience of something larger than yourself, larger than your own ego, larger than your appetites of what you want, what you like, what you dislike. Spirituality is an experience of being connected, of being inescapably bound to the human family and to the universe beyond. Now, this can include a concept of God or the divine, but it doesn't have to. Because a number of you are very, very spiritual, and you are humanists. You have no notion of God and yet care deeply, deeply for the human family and for the common good. I do believe, though, that as we enter the public square and interact with lots of other people, especially different communities of faith, we need to be able to use spiritual language. Because actually, only the language of the heart can address these matters. For how else can we speak of love for the stranger? How else can we speak of empathy and compassion, of heartbreak and hope? When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, and fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I can do what Wendell Berry does in this poem, go down to the water and come into the peace of wild things. But sometimes what I want to do is remember those who have gone before me, those whose lives and times were much, much darker than ours. In 1952, a decade before the Civil War would begin, Frederick Douglass was invited to speak to a group of abolitionists in Rochester, New York. It was July 4th. He was asked to speak on the meaning of Independence Day for him. So his speech starts as any good July 4th speech would start, honoring our forefathers and their courageous call to judge all forms of tyranny and all forms of oppression. Douglass applauds the Declaration of Independence as it announces the advent of a nation based upon human brotherhood, a nation based on the self-evident truths of liberty and equality. Its mission is the redemption of the world from the bondage of the ages. And he goes on and on like this, just lifting up the forefathers, their courageous speech. 30 minutes of this wonderful lauding of these great men and these great ideals. But the tension you can feel is building in this text, and you're thinking, something is going to happen. He must be going someplace with this. And he keeps going. He says, they succeeded. They succeeded. Today you reap the fruits of their success. The freedom gained is yours, and therefore you properly celebrate this occasion of your independence. Ah, wonderful. You can imagine lots of clapping. And then here it comes. He says, the fault is not with the forefathers, but with their children and their grandchildren. He holds up the Constitution, crinkles it in his hands, and he says, this instrument is neither warrant, license, or sanction of the hateful thing. It will be found to contain principles and purposes entirely hostile to the existence of slavery. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. Douglass speaks of heartache. Douglass speaks of heartache, just as we must learn to do. He ends his message, however, not in despair, but in hope. I do not despair of this country, he says. While drawing on the encouragement from the Declaration of Independence, my spirit is also cheered by the obvious tendencies of the age. So even as the clouds of war were looming, there were scientific advancements. There was the growing abolitionist movement. There was the growing women's movement. And then there was technology that was drawing people closer and closer together. And we too can find signs of hope in this land where hope becomes capacity. I see it out here. I see it on Dog Street. I saw it in Providence last week at our General Assembly. I see it wearing yellow shirts and standing on the side of love, and I see it blossoming in thousands and thousands of young people. And here's just one example of how ordinary men and women are beginning to engage in local government. And they're doing it by creating apps Yes, there's an app for that. They're creating apps to strengthen the connection between citizens and their governments. So one example is an app to adopt a fire hydrant. Last winter, when there was so much snow up north, these little things were completely covered and no one knew where the fire hydrants were. And so this little app was created by a young adult, and it's very simple. You adopt a fire hydrant. With that, you get the right to name it, which is fun, right? And you have the obligation to clean it and make sure that it's visible and free of snow. And if you're not doing your job, someone else can swoop in and adopt that fire hydrant. So there's a little game involved in that too. Lots and lots of potential out there. Lots of points of hope. Lots of opportunity and creativity out there. Maybe you, like me, have come to America from somewhere else, and it seems easier somehow to appreciate this country when you're coming to it. Or maybe you have experienced looking at this country from the bottom up, and maybe sometimes that's what it takes to appreciate the potential. This place needs good citizens. And not just good citizens, it needs great citizens to love it enough to reimagine it and to remake it. May it be so. Amen.